This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is June 25th, 2020, and this is episode 195.
I'm Scott Delinnebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, BC enters Phase 3, the legislature resumes, and we're in a continued standoff with China. Thank you to the 101 people who contribute every month. Our newest patron is Ross. Thank you very much. Join Ross and many others at patreon.com/politicos. Or if you want, you can send us an Interac e-transfer by emailing it to leginbootmedia@gmail.com. For the duration of the crisis, we've opened up our patron Slack to all our listeners. Visit leginbootmedia.ca to request an invite. Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicos, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's jump into our first segment, Back in the Legislature. Doesn't quite rhyme with back in the USSR, but that's what I was going for. It's better when I explain my jokes. BC has launched into phase three of our COVID response level, which I keep seeing is basically phase two, but they're not going to judge you as much if you travel around the province.
Well, it's not quite that simple. It does also mean industries such as film can get started back up again, which is a major part of the economy here. So there is more than just people won't frown at you quite as much if you drive around the province a little more.
And it's interesting as you kind of look at the daily case numbers, we're staying in a reasonably low level. I think today was the highest at 20 or 19 cases, 19 positive tests and one Epilink case.
So I can remember when 20 cases was a good news day.
Yeah. And now we're kind of trying to stay there or lower. And
yeah, we've been in a band of kind of 5 to 20 for the past couple weeks now. It's in that range. It's been fairly flat, but I don't know. I feel a little more comfortable with phase three if we actually had a zero case day.
Well, we had the modeling come out, I think, earlier this week that showed we seem to be sitting around 65% normal social interactions, which is right on the precipice, the cliff's edge of going back into outbreaks and keeping it at a nice stable equilibrium of a few cases a day. Each person who gets it basically transmits to one other, and that is pretty manageable from public health's perspective. That's a very nervous situation to be in, though, sitting right on that edge. I'd like to see it a little bit less.
Yeah, particularly as we move into a different phase.
Mm-hmm. But within this phase, we have the legislature reopening. The session started on Monday for a six-week sitting. Through the summer, there's going to be no more than 25, I believe it is, MLAs in the chamber, including the speaker. Most of the committees are holding via Zoom, and they have giant television screens within the legislative chamber for many of the MLAs who can connect from home. And so there's a lot more remember to unmute yourselves and extra pauses. But otherwise, it seems like it's going pretty well.
Yep, seems to be doing so. And as part of legislature resuming, bills that are starting to be introduced again. We got a bunch of them this week, which is pretty normal for the start of a session.
Only it's not fully the start of a new session. We didn't ever end the spring session. And so there are still five bills on the order paper. A couple were at first reading, but they've all advanced to committee stage in the last week. There's updates to the Employment Standards Amendment Act to give 5 paid days leave for survivors of domestic sexual violence. There's the vehicle insurance, the big ICBC changes that are still sitting on the order paper, some other Motor Vehicle Amendment Act changes to alter training requirements for driver's licenses, the evidence changes for that David Eby is also hoping to reduce the number of expert witnesses that can be introduced in automobile injuries, and then just a miscellaneous amendment act. So a lot of the big ICBC changes are still waiting further debate. And given the government wants to roll out their enhanced care or not no fault insurance system next year, we'll have to see if those all make it through.
Yeah, we're still a ways off from a provincial election, but it's getting close enough. They don't want to be pushing through big structural changes to anything as it gets really, really close. So they're no doubt conscious of time and want to push that along as quickly as they can.
Nevertheless, there was a bevy of new bills released this week. I counted at least, I think it was 7 or 8 different ones. Some are very minor, like the amendments to the Wills and Succession Act, which just allows people to sign wills electronically. Other amendments to the Motor Vehicle Act that basically allow you to update your insurance easier and not need to get new stickers every year for your license plates. Mines and Clean Energy Amendment Acts that basically just clean up some of the complexities around there, and also allow BC Hydro to add new energy sources to its portfolio. So nothing too major or seemingly controversial. I mean, maybe I'm missing something in the Mines Act. It's not my specialty or focus.
I haven't done a deep dive into that either, but that is one of those potential areas where there can be something that stirs up a lot of controversy. But so far, there's not much indication of that. What I think is probably going to be maybe a little more controversial is the Bill 18, the Economic Stabilization Act, which lets the province run a budget deficit for the next 3 years, which I mean, everyone was expecting as soon as COVID hit, but it's now being formalized.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we have a law that bans budget deficits, which is largely a fake law, right? It's on paper. It's done as political theater. You know, it's not the end of the world.
It's entirely ceremonial.
Yeah, it's not a big deal if a government runs a deficit every now or then, especially in a situation like this. And this bill kind of shows that, yes, you can undo those with just another piece of legislation. It's actually kind of surprising the government decided to only go for 3 years rather than just to eliminate the balanced budget law entirely. I guess it's a kind of way to signal and not give talking points to the BC Liberals that they're going to be a perpetual deficit government.
Yeah, but still, at the same time, there's such a clear case of why it's needed here that the chance of any political blowback really landing and causing any damage is pretty tiny.
Yeah, that bill also includes some of the previously announced measures, including the tax deferrals for many businesses and people who are getting a little bit of a reprieve from the government. One of the other sort of related acts coming out of COVID-19 is literally called the COVID-19 Related Measures Act, Bill 19, which when you read it, it basically takes the ministerial orders that were passed during or under the Emergency Measures Act and allows the government to keep those in place for 45 or 90 days after the end of the state of emergency. And it generally moves a lot of power to cabinet that wouldn't otherwise be there. So the way our Emergency Measures Act operates is when we're in a state of emergency, which we continue to be, the government can do a lot more, but not as much as they think it turns out. And we'll talk about that in a bit, but they can do a lot more to quickly change laws or loosen up restrictions or tighten new restrictions to help respond to that crisis. So this act is interesting because I think the argument for it is, well, we might end the state of emergency at some point soon. Maybe things are calm enough, but we want to keep the things we enacted outside the legislature in place, which is a transfer of power from the legislature to the executive, clearly. Although there is a time limit on this, and I think the maximum would be 1 year of keeping additional emergency measures in the hands of cabinet. Like, it's a very wonky and niche kind of issue, but for people who care about divisions of powers, this is one I think people should look a bit closer at and decide whether this feels like a justified move, or if it would just be better to keep the state of emergency in place for an extra month or two.
The sunset provision in there does reassure me, so I think it's not going to be a case where it's that problematic that they've given themselves these extra measures, as long as it is temporary.
I mean, the default of Canadian parliaments and legislatures is to just centralize more power in the executive, so it's not too surprising of an act, but I can see why some of the measures might need a little bit longer, even though we're not in an official emergency. One of the other interesting bills that's been brought forward that I think we're both looking at is the Strata Amendment Act, essentially the one that's looking at municipal affairs and housing. And this is what the government is calling their first step to tackling the spiraling out of control insurance, strata insurance market. So there have been a number of stories in the last year or two of strata's condos facing, you know, 200-400% increases in their premiums as the insurance market just decides they don't have the capacity to afford buildings with giant liabilities. And this is, you know, hitting strata's as a whole. So the entire building is sometimes struggling to get insurance. And it's sometimes hitting individual property owners who are trying to get contents insurance, who are looking at their property's deductible go double or triple. So, you know, I had to update my strata or my property insurance recently, and we saw a 20% increase in our premium because some of our deductibles had doubled. The act itself, though, kind of tweaks around the edges, and I'm not sure if it will accomplish the solutions that we need to see for what is a pretty big crisis.
Yeah, I took a quick look through the text of it and wasn't entirely clear what it was going to do, because it's a statutes amendment act where it changes a bunch of clauses here and there in minor ways. And you actually need to go back and check against the original legislation to really understand what's going on. There's helpful little explainers, though, on the BC Ledge website, which is appreciated. But yeah, overall, it just makes a few minor tweaks here and there and kind of gets the ball rolling in a lot of ways. But there's going to be a lot of stuff coming after this to really tackle it, including a bunch of regulations that will be put out that this enables.
Yeah, the way I read it from the government's releases was that this is a bill that basically increases some of the reporting requirements. So strata, you know, you can have the case where you have a bad strata council that doesn't do the depreciation reports and doesn't do its due diligence in the way it should. And so this is forcing...
Oh, crazy that that's even allowed.
Yeah. And so this is taking care of some of that, which that will help in some cases. But I mean, a depreciation report that says your building is going to fall apart is not going to help you get insurance. I mean, not much is going to help you get insurance in that point, but, you know, it's a tough situation. And, you know, it's a very big challenge because you have not too many, you have, I think, fewer and fewer companies and agencies that are actually insuring buildings because it's a very expensive market and there's not, it's tough. So a good start, but I'll really have to wait to see what Minister Robinson and the government can come up with on this. You know, maybe we give ICBC some power to run a strata insurance market.
It's not the crazy suggestion out there. One of the big problems with insurance in general is that there's a lot of adverse selection going on. And I mean, typically it's talked about in terms of people, when there's a voluntary insurance thing, not wanting to insure unless they're high risk. But the flip side of that is you can get a lot of insurance companies not wanting to insure certain markets. So,
yeah. And I mean,
it's one of the markets where more government intervention actually makes more sense.
Yeah. And any insurance market is almost stronger, more centralized when you have a bigger pool of assets so that, you know, if one building needs a giant payout, it doesn't hit all of the others in that company's portfolio. So pooling it can help. The challenge is you don't want to put strata insurance on the back of all British Columbian taxpayers because not all British Columbians live in a strata. It's a kind of privilege, like it's a homeowning situation, right? It's more privileged than not, and we don't necessarily need to bail out homeowners.
Well, as a class, like, yeah, homeowners already get a lot of subsidy in various ways. So, I mean, hell, if they cancel the homeowners grant and shift that subsidy over to insurance, it might actually be a net positive, but
yeah,
there's a bunch of complications, no doubt. And yeah, it's an imperfect solution.
Well, and the final bill that I'm taking a stronger look at was just introduced in the last couple of days is the Mental Health Amendment Act from the Ministry of Mental Health, which proposes to, quote, stabilize care for youth following an overdose. And the idea is to permit the government to take kids into custody if they are deemed to be in a dangerous situation and force them into treatment. This has been something I think the BC Liberals have been pushing on for a while, and the government has generally avoided it for the civil libertarian reasons and just the general approach, at least that I believe, that forcing someone into a treatment for substance use is rarely effective. It was interesting to see the chief coroner, Lisa Lapointe, issue a statement right after this bill came out saying, without an established evidence-based accessible system of substance use treatment services, she's concerned there is potential for serious unintended consequences as a result of these legislative amendments, including the potential for an increase in fatalities. And the argument there is that, and I saw this from some drug user activists, is if teenagers, for example, know that there's a risk they'll be arrested for seeking some treatment, they'll go further underground, use in more dangerous situations, and it's a net negative overall. Like, it's better to try and take the harm reduction approach rather than just, even if we never end up using the arrest abilities, it's a kind of dangerous pause.
I think I saw it was a 7 day?
Yeah, it's two, it would be for 48 hours up to seven.
Yeah, up to a maximum of 7 days.
Short-term emergency care.
Yeah, and that is only following a life-threatening overdose. So it's, I hear the concerns, but at the same time, it's just another tool in the toolbox, but needs to be paired with a lot more options as well to put a complete picture together on that.
Yeah, it was just most notable for me to see the chief coroner speak out so strongly about a proposed amendment. I know a lot of activists are going to be watching this closely and trying to push back on it, and so I'll definitely be keeping my eye on that. But along with the bevy of bills, there have been a few regulation changes and regulatory changes as we sort of that are tied with, I guess, the shift from phase two to phase three. You wanted to flag some of the changes to tenancy rules that have come up recently.
Yeah, so back when the crisis started, BC put in place a bunch of rules around banning evictions, as well as rules about what landlords can and can't do. So in the latter case, for example, they limited non-emergency entry of landlords into tenant suites. In normal times, there's a 24-hour notice period. That was just limited to emergencies only. That's being rolled back, as well as the province is now changing the regulations back to what they were when it comes to evictions, with the exception of non-payment of rent. That particular eviction ban staying in place for the time being, as well as the renter's assistance is being extended.
Yeah, so the money is still there. That is flowing till the end of August. But these changes on eviction questions are raising some concerns among tenant activists and tenant organizers, because, you know, it will result in some people being evicted, whether it's for rent eviction type situations, maybe not exactly that, but anytime you have a property that someone wants to renovate, maybe the landlord wants to move back in. You know, there's a number of situations that will come up, and it'll be interesting to see what the effect of this is and if there's going to be a sort of, oh, well, I'm not evicting them for not paying. I'm evicting them for these other reasons, and how those kind of sort out. But, you know, we're in a slightly better situation than we were a couple months ago. So, you know, these weren't going to last forever. So
No, it was always going to be a temporary measure because you do want there to be methods for a landlord to evict someone if necessary. And that can be for stuff like wanting to move back into one's own property. And it's important to have that option available. So it made sense as we're coming out of the worst of the crisis that that gets reinstated as an option.
At least until we eliminate the need for private landlords and the drain they create on the economy.
That's not really going to happen.
No, not under this government or one we're likely to get.
Or so. Really any likely government.
All right. In addition to the regulatory changes around renting, there's a number of new reports and other task force being formed. The first one that was actually quite shocking earlier this week was the announcement and the release of some findings that there are allegations of racism in the healthcare system, particularly up north. When I saw that headline, it kind of just raises flags. And when you dig into the story, it turns out nurses in ERs in certain hospitals were playing games of guess the blood alcohol content of typically indigenous patients as they come in or people they thought might be. And I get that there's a dark humor that kind of goes along with anyone who works in these kind of very traumatic fields like ER healthcare, but, you know, playing on these stereotypes and these racist tropes is very dangerous and can have a very direct effect on the health outcomes of the patients. So the province has launched a task force to review this and has appointed well-known, very reputable lawyer, Mary Ellen Turple-LaFond, to investigate it and start to figure out what's happening, root out the problems, and try to make sure our healthcare system is equitable and not racist.
So where they go. Another report that just got released was from the Office of the Ombudsperson. It related to two of the ministerial orders that were put forward during the crisis. So this is specifically orders MO98, which suspends the limitation periods and allows statutory decision makers to waive, suspend, or extend mandatory timeframes relating to their decision-making powers. What it sounds like basically allows them to put stuff off that they're statutorily required to do in light of the pandemic. And then Ministerial Order M139, which exempted local governments from a bunch of statutory requirements around the conduct of meetings and public hearings and passage of bylaws. And the ombudsperson found that the ministers didn't actually have the authority to issue these orders.
Yeah, the second one is the really interesting one, as that was issued so that municipalities could hold virtual public hearings or skip them in some cases or still get around and still function.
They couldn't skip them, but they could...
Or hold hearings without the public in attendance, for example, at council meetings.
Yeah, but the council meetings themselves could be done without public attendance and the public hearings should be moved entirely virtually.
And a number of bylaws have been passed under that order. And they're now, I guess, in question of, are they valid since arguably they were unconstitutional? The minister notably did replace that second order with a newer one, which the ombudsperson says is an improvement, but there are still some, it's still not perfect. There's still questions that could be raised about it. Some of these issues were addressed in Bill 19, the COVID-19 Related Measures Act, which is positive to see that the government listened very quickly to these flags. But yeah, this still leaves a lot of questions about what will happen with municipalities where there might be contentions about how they proceeded.
Yeah, so I'm just looking at this now. So the final revision to the order that got passed was M192. Yeah, I'm looking on the City of Vancouver website right now for probably I'm actually going to be speaking that after we finish recording here. And they're still listing M139. So there's clearly a few things that still need to be sorted out here on that. So the specific reason why the ombudsperson found that these were not legal orders was that the ministers don't actually have the ability to just decide certain statutes aren't applicable anymore, even in an emergency case, which, you know, makes a lot of sense from a rule of law point of view, and good they're catching that. But yeah, like you said, it's going to need some fixes at the back end to get these to be suitable so that local governments can actually carry on their business as needed.
I mean, for all the different changes we've made as a society through COVID-19, the like technical wonky cleanups of so many laws and bills is probably going to be like one of the most likely to actually stick. Like, there's a lot of things that I've half joked, half seriously wished could be more permanent or a better way to do things on a longer term. But what I think we'll mostly see is just all of these bills and all these laws become more nimble at allowing, well, even just modernized, you know, allowing hearings to be online in part and allowing people to participate in things virtually, or societies to hold meetings virtually. And that's good.
Yeah, it's definitely good. The public hearings that are required anytime a city wants to change its zoning, which happens a lot, they're required to do a public hearing. And they're horribly unrepresentative because, well, who has time to spend 4 hours on a random weekday night at City Hall, except, you know, well-off homeowners who don't have much else going on? So there's a bunch of problems with them that they should definitely look at updating, and allowing people to call in does incrementally move things to a slightly more representative way. So that's good. It's a little, but like you said, it's annoying that it took a pandemic to actually get this underway. And there's a lot of little things like that throughout society that, when push comes to shove, if, you know, restaurants can sell alcohol for a delivery now, there was clearly never any real reason why they couldn't have done it before, except...
Or that they can buy it at wholesale prices rather than liquor store prices.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, there's this line that's been thrown about like there's no libertarians in a pandemic, but the libertarians kind of had a point about a lot of these laws and regulations that, once we hit an emergency, turned out not to actually have any real use to them.
Quite indeed. The final thing on BC politics before we shift gears, that I guess turns out also arguably doesn't have a use, at least in Alan Mullen's view, is the Sergeant at Arms. Richard Zussman for Global News got a copy of the report that he had submitted to the Legislative Affairs Management Committee, LAMC, earlier this year, that's been under lock and key since then. This is the report he generated, I believe, following his driving tour around North America, visiting different legislatures.
Western North America, I think it was. I don't think he visited the Florida legislature.
No.
But he, yeah, spent a bunch of time, and I think it was $13,000, driving around both Canada and the U.S., looking at how they handle their legislative security. And in the end, he's recommending that the sergeant-at-arms and head-of-security positions be split apart, and the sergeant-at-arms gets basically relegated to a ceremonial position, while security is headed up by a separate individual.
And this is a pretty interesting recommendation, because he also goes and says that we should repeal the Legislative Assembly police force and replace it with more of a security force, which is actually a very interesting call, right? As people talk about defunding the police, I don't think most activists had strong opinions about the Legislative Assembly police force, but suddenly Alan Mullen is on their side.
Yeah, although the report also recommends moving to an unarmed security force, which probably not a great idea. It wasn't that long ago that armed security at the federal legislature was needed to stop a shooter. So it was one of those things, like, you do actually want to have that level of protection at a major government building like that. So
I mean, that's one case in 20, 30 years of all of Canada's legislatures, which, you know, building policy off exceptional situations is probably not the best approach. With security, you do want to be cautious.
Well, the thing is, you want to protect against the tail events, the unlikely but quite damaging events. And security is one of those things where, yeah, the worst case scenario may happen very rarely, but you do need to be prepared for it.
The report does put out that making the changes suggested, I believe, could save about $1 million a year for the BC legislature, as the police force that they have right now, I believe, is like almost 40 armed constables or full-time constables, which is not a small force for the legislature. And this would help. I mean, if we saved $1 million a year, it makes his $13,000 trip around the Western continent a splash in the bucket. That said, Alan Mullen and Daryl Plekis have clearly had it out for, not had it out for, but have clearly been focusing their eye on the sergeant at arms and security and arrangement around the legislature. And it's always been this back and forth of, they do seem to have a lot of good points, but the way they go about recommending or tackling them have always raised eyebrows. So it's a question of, I guess, whether this is something LAMC is going to take up seriously, or if it's going to kind of gather dust. And I guess we'll have to wait and see what the committee decides to do. I think they've probably been focused on quite a few other things recently, but eventually this will come back to their desk.
Moving on to our second segment, to Mites for a Meng. This past week, China officially charged the two Canadians they're holding, Michael Torvig and Michael Spavor, with espionage. These are the two individuals who China arrested shortly after Canada detained Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou at the Vancouver airport. And until now, they have been held without charge in China, and China is now moving ahead with officially charging them.
Yeah, the related story to this is it's now coming out sort of indirectly through one of their spouses, one of the Michael's spouses, that if Canada releases Meng Wanzhou, China will happily, or maybe not happily, but will release these two Michaels.
It's not just from the spouse. A spokesman for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs explicitly linked the two, basically removing any subtext from this and making a pretty explicit example of text that these two Canadians are being held as bargaining chips or leverage to try and stop the extradition of Meng Wanzhou.
One of the other stories that also came out is there's this group of parliamentarians, diplomats, who include former Supreme Court Justice Louise Arbour, former Liberal Foreign Affairs Minister Lloyd Axworthy, former Conservative Foreign Affairs Minister Lawrence Cannon, Q. Segal, former Conservative Senator, and even NDP former leader Ed Broadbent, and many others, who cite some specific legal opinions saying the Justice Minister will have to make a choice at a certain time and can use and has the authority to consider political situations and realities in that before an extradition is granted. And so the Foreign Affairs Minister, or sorry, the Attorney General, can make a call about whether to have her be extradited or to essentially just release her. And the diplomats and parliamentarians here say, you know what, it's probably cleaner just to let her go back to China.
Yeah. So I think Andrew Coyne probably said it best. That legal opinion was more of a political opinion being covered as a legal opinion, because everybody knew that the Attorney General does have the ultimate sign-off on any extradition. But this really is a political argument that Canada is better off trading away Meng for the two Canadians. So that's been put out last couple of days. Trudeau today responded with a pretty emphatic not going to happen. And I think his reasoning was pretty compelling on this, that basically if countries around the world, I'm quoting him now, countries around the world, including China, realize that by arbitrarily arresting random Canadians, they can get what they want out of Canada politically. Well, that makes an awful lot more Canadians who travel around the world vulnerable to that kind of pressure. And he's not wrong on that.
I mean, it's a nice bit of rhetoric from Trudeau, but it's also largely, I think, bullshit. Because what's the other side of it? That if Canadians are arrested arbitrarily, that our foreign affairs team is going to go too bad? Like, what exactly is Canada doing to get these two out of jail?
I believe there are a bunch of diplomats in China right now from Canada working on this very question. It's not like we've just completely ignored it, but there's also a pretty clear line that we're not going to cross, and in my opinion, shouldn't cross on this one, that we will grant political consideration for their release.
I mean, this entire situation is just like aggravating and frustrating for me. Like, Meng Wanzhou is in custody in Canada, not because we have decided she's broken our law, although there's this question about whether the fraud that she did to the U.S., as we discussed on a previous case, was ruled to be, or, you know, it was ruled that she may have committed fraud through some definition of it, so her case will continue. Well, but the primary reason she's under arrest is because the U.S. wants her under arrest for their own, you know, purposes. And, you know, whether or not those are valid or not is not a Canadian legal issue. It's whether or not we send her away. And so we're basically just playing for the U.S. here. And, you know, there are times we do that and there are times we haven't in the past. And I'm struggling to see what's the benefit to Canada of keeping Meng Wanzhou in this extradition hearing.
Well, we do have an extradition treaty with the U.S. that we would like to maintain. And should any Canadian or should any person commit a crime in Canada and flee to the U.S., we would like to be able to have the Americans arrest them and extradite them to Canada to face justice. And it is in our general interest to maintain that ability.
But the Americans aren't going to tear up our extradition treaty if we've decided for political reasons that we're going to release her. I mean, it's the same way as, like, we didn't go to Iraq, yet we still maintained a good alliance within NATO with the U.S. Like, Canada can take a stand that's different than the U.S. at times and not just be effectively, you know, a hapless lapdog.
Right. But at the same time, what's the benefit for Canada of given into China's demands on this?
And we get our Canadians back.
But yeah, but when China took the hostages, I think they kind of forced our hand not to release Meng Wanzhou because of the reasons that Trudeau articulated, that if we, now that there have been hostages taken, if we give into that, that it sends an explicit signal that the next time China is in a dispute with us, they should arbitrarily arrest two more Canadians in order to get what they want on that case.
I just feel like we're playing this zero-sum, black-and-white approach to foreign policy where we have the good guys, America, and the bad guys, China. And it's, you know, if there, we can build positive relationships in both directions. For the longest time, we had started to go down a stronger relationship with China, even though, you know, there's still flags and we need to talk. You know, we can't let them off the hook for human rights abuses or any of that. But at the same time, you know, it's not zero sum. We can try to work together and work with trade. Like, other countries don't have these as many issues.
Well, it's hardly.
Or maybe they just avoid it.
There are plenty of countries that are facing issues with China, whether it's Australia, which has had similar issues that we're having, whether it's China's neighbors in the South China Sea, who are quite rightly annoyed at China for claiming large chunks of it that are outside of its maritime boundaries. Yeah, I get that we want this to be positive sum, but there are some cases where there are just going to be zero sum decisions, and this looks like one of them. Like, there doesn't appear to be an obvious positive sum way out of this. And ultimately we're going to have to make a choice one way or the other on this, and siding with the US as a default makes a lot more sense than siding with China on zero-sum issues like this, because we have a very important alliance with the United States, and advancing China's interests is not really something that is generally in Canada's interest on this. And if it does become an explicitly political decision, we ought to side with the US because it matters more for Canada's long-term security and prosperity that that we maintain our relationship with the US.
I push back, though. I think like the approach the US has taken to foreign policy, particularly recently, but for a long time, has been one that is a greater threat to world stability, is a greater threat to peace. Like China aside, for the US, we're talking about decades of coups in South America, destabilizing the Middle East. The US has been a big blockage to peace in between Israel and Palestine. It's only recently that Canada finally broke and joined the larger international consensus in trying to move to recognize Palestinian statehood once again. Like, Canada can take an independent approach that can also criticize China's threat to the world and world peace, while not just siding uncritically with the states. I don't know. Maybe we arrest her under our own law and keep her in Canada. Maybe that's the worst situation.
I think that would actually just make everything worse.
Yeah.
The US wouldn't get what they want. China would. Yeah, it's a complicated situation. But at the end of the day, Canada should not send a signal that hostage diplomacy is how you get what you want from Canada.
Maybe we send. No, I was thinking of an even worse strategy of sending a covert mission into China. And that would obviously be bad. Never mind that. We're not going to extradite or, you know, go and rescue these people. Unfortunately, it's tough. I do hope we can find a better solution.
So a little too Hollywood an outcome.
Yeah.
Well, one group that does want Canada to get a little tougher on China is a group of 12 senators who are mostly conservatives, but not entirely. We're calling on the government to impose or enact a law that we have on our books that allows us to target the personal finances of foreign officials responsible for violating human rights and freeze those assets in Canada and forbid Canadian institutions from doing business with them. China's obviously engaged in a lot of human rights abuses, and that would allow us to target quite a few individuals within their government if we enacted on that.
Remember, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, China decided, may have even just been last year, China decided they were going to stop taking canola imports from Canada. And suddenly, like, it almost crushed a big chunk of our agricultural industry. That's what happens if we start going after their officials. Like, we like to pretend we could play strong. And, you know, I commend them for saying we should take action on these human rights abuses. And that's not something I disagree with. But China is a bigger country and will crush us if we try to fight an economic war with them. And they've proven that they'll do it.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk out of particularly the Conservative Party about getting tough on China. And it's not the sort of thing that's easily done. It will take quite a bit of finesse. And it's one thing to not give in to unreasonable demands, like we were talking about earlier. But it's quite another to start a tit for tat with them that we're not necessarily going to be able to come out ahead on. And if this was a more coordinated action with other friendly governments, such as EU countries, Britain, Australia, the US, it might be more effective as a coordinated effort, but just Canada going alone, we're just not big enough. And as long as Canada is a smallish country of 38 million, we're just not going to have the ability to really throw our weight around so much because we just don't have that much weight. And if we want to change that, that's something we should maybe look at. But as long as we're such a small fraction of China's population and economy, we're not going to be able to have much ability. And right, as long as we're only a tenth the size of the US, we're going to be reliant on them for a lot of things too. And there's just limits to what Canada can do solo here. And I don't know, maybe it would have been good if the Liberals had spent more time with their foreign affairs team working on strengthening those relationships and building up a more united front against China than pointlessly campaigning for a Security Council seat.
Although, to be fair, I don't think that was actually such a huge, like, listening to the latest Boys in Short Pants, where they really dig into that campaign, it was a small fraction. You know, it was 11 people and a small amount of money. But I don't think Global Affairs has a clear mandate about what they're doing on any question.
It may have been a small fraction on the staffing level at the civil service. It did not seem to be a particularly small fraction of the political level's commitment to foreign policy.
Fair. I do think this just plays into a larger attempted conservative narrative to get out there of really trying to be tough on China, tough on communism, that kind of thing. It gets me, though, that, like, when you think about it, like, I brought up the canola sanctions for a specific reason. Like, those hit the those hit conservative ridings. Like, those hit Alberta, Saskatchewan, rural ridings where conservatives run up the table. That, so there's a weird, like, political calculus where the things they want to do are things that could actually indirectly hurt their own voters.
Yeah, although it's not like the conservatives are going to lose rural Saskatchewan even in trade war.
True,
yeah.
Very true.
Like, the conservatives aren't necessarily wrong that the Liberal Party in general has historically approached China with rose-colored glasses and assumed they're going to probably be more amenable to Canada's interests than has been borne out by fact. But it's not clear that we'll be tougher is an inherently better strategy, because there isn't anything really articulated behind that in how that actually gets executed in practice. And that's really going to make a big difference when you're the smaller player in a game.
Yeah. One of the other things they were talking about on the Boys in Short Pants is how Canada we need to accept we're a small country. Like Norway and Ireland, who won Security Council seats, they both accept that they're small countries and act as such. Canada, I think, is still in this, we're a middle power. You know, we're not America, but we're not a nowhere, you know, a country you haven't heard of or something like that. And while Canada isn't the smallest economy and we are in G7, we're kind of at the bottom of those lists. We're like we're the biggest of the small countries. And maybe we could be a big fish in the small pond rather than be the small fish in the big pond.
Yeah, like Norway has a population the size of BC. So it's, yeah, definitely a lot smaller, but Canada doesn't necessarily have the same position globally that it did at the end of World War II. And we need to realize that trying to basically recreate like the Pearson era view of Canada's place in the world isn't a practical one in entering the third decade now of this century. And it's going to be tough, and we're going to have to, I think, actually have a serious conversation at some point about what Canada's foreign policy is, what its place in the world is, how it substantively advances its own interests. And Canada, for whatever reason, has a political culture that is not amenable to making those conversations easy. And maybe it's the benefit of geography being separated from all of our potential adversaries and allied with not only a major superpower, but like the superpower in our hemisphere that's right beside us. We tend to not want to talk about foreign policy issues very seriously. And we've kind of had the luxury of not doing that. And that's seems to be coming to an end pretty quick. And Canada better start having those discussion soon, because it's going to get a lot worse if we don't.
I mean, there's also a bit of a consensus, I think, around Ottawa bubbles, whether it's conservative or a liberal government, about what sort of approaches to take globally. And it's largely aligned with U.S. interests. And so when there's challenges to that and challenges about when those interests may collide with Canada's interests,
yeah,
I think there's a hesitancy among that establishment to really engage with those questions. And, you know, the NDP has never formed government, so they can't really mount an effective critique of our federal foreign policy situation. I don't think Jagmeet Singh or even Tom Mulcair or Jack Layton had a strong position on that. And so the NDP has just tried to keep their head down as well on these questions and focus domestically, where they do tend to be stronger on issues.
I don't think, even if the NDP somehow did the impossible and formed government in Canada, I don't think it's that likely that they'd actually end up straying too far from what has been Canada's foreign policy to date. Foreign policy is one of those things that operates in a space with a lot of constraints, and geography and economic reasons does significantly constrain Canada's ability to operate significantly independently of the U.S. Like, we're just so well tied together, so well integrated, and geography is kind of forcing us to do that. Would be very hard for any government to substantively depart from that.
Well, I'm moving on to just a couple quick takes to close us off today. Canada's credit rating has been downgraded by Fitch as our deficit continues to balloon due to coronavirus spending.
Yeah, so they're one of the credit rating agencies. They've bumped us from a AAA to a AA+. Because of all the new debt we've taken on as a result of coronavirus and the economic responses to that. So, like, these credit ratings are basically an assessment of how likely Canada is to repay, and that can affect what our ability or how good an interest rate we can get when we issue debt. Yeah, a AA+ is still pretty good. It's not going to substantially change everything. Every other country in the world is taking on huge amounts of debt too. So it's not like we're going to become relatively less attractive as a place to purchase bonds from. So, like, overall, it's not a big deal one way or the other. And it's going to cause some political hay. The Conservatives will no doubt use this to point to, you know, Trudeau's reckless spending and how they should have brought the deficit down under control earlier. And yeah, it'll make a bit of it on the margins, makes a bit of a difference, but overall, it's not a huge thing. This probably would have been coming whether or not we'd ran a balanced budget for the last 4 years.
Yeah, and BC is still sitting at a AAA credit rating, though there are some flags on that because similarly, we have big deficits lining up. But, you know, interest rates are still low, so this isn't going to hurt too much. And presuming we can get things back on track.
Yeah, and the Bank of Canada's doing everything it can to keep interest rates pretty low during this time too. So it's not like the credit rating agency is the sole determinant of it. Plus the other two major agencies still have us at a AAA. So it's even only one of three right now. And like, having a good credit rating's, you know, a nice feather in your cap, but it's also an argument that, you know, if you're have such a high credit rating, it does mean you might be leaving some money on the table that you could borrow to invest in, you know, long-term productivity enhancing investments in Canada. And that, you know, maybe in the time of low interest rates, the right balance isn't necessarily triple A in that case. And finally, follow up to our discussion last week, and I guess ties into our second segment a bit too, Foreign Affairs Minister Philippe Champagne has repaid the mortgages he owed to a state-owned bank in China. These were for the two properties in the UK that he'd taken out a mortgage for when he was living in the UK, working there prior to entering politics. And yeah, as we discussed last week, it wasn't a great look and did raise some questions about the judgment of him and the prime minister and why he still had these even after entering public service and becoming minister of foreign affairs. But he has now repaid those mortgages, no longer owes a Chinese state-owned bank any money, which is, you know, good, but why did it take a story in the Globe and Mail for that to happen is, I guess, my big question out of all of it.
I guess, I don't know, maybe he's the kind of wealthy aristocrat who just forgets how many mortgages and properties he owns.
You know, the 1.2 million mortgage is just a rounding error on the...
I mean, you outsource all this to your accountant and let them deal with it. He probably... I mean, the point is he should have done this when he took the job in cabinet or even before that.
Yeah, because it was disclosed too. So like it got onto the disclosure filing. So like it like that should have been a red flag then.
I mean, the other thing, the other lesson here is go read those disclosure filings. There's sometimes some good juice in there.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised it took that long for that to raise any red flags because he's been elected since 2015.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'd think someone would have looked at them before 2020.
But here we are.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.